Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We start off the show today with a new stat on inequality. In the United States, more than half of all the students in public schools are poor. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, January 16th, and it's great to have you with us. Today, the most important person in healthcare you probably have never heard of said she plans to retire next month. Marilyn Taverner runs CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. She oversees those two giant healthcare programs. What makes her job so important, to borrow a phrase from E.F. Hutton, is that when CMS talks, people listen. Why is that? From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein explains.
Money. That's why people listen to CMS. Money and power. Dr. Mark McClellan ran the office under George W. Bush.
CMS has a budget of over $800 billion.
The agency has all that money because it insures about one out of every three Americans. 50 million are enrolled in Medicare, 80 million in Medicaid. And when you pay so many bills, you get to call the shots.
It would be difficult to overstate the significant impact that CMS has.
Kevin Tabb is the CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Half of his patients are on Medicare or Medicaid. And Tabb says CMS influences the other half, too. Take pills, for example.
It is frequently CMS that will decide whether a medication will be paid for or not. And when that happens, commercial insurance companies will frequently follow suit.
There's another power at CMS's disposal, data. Former Obama CMS chief Don Berwick says the office is sitting on a gold mine of information that can improve care and lower costs.
It's one place where the lights can get turned on how we're doing, how we can learn from each other, and how we can detect problems.
To do that, Berwick knows, will take guts, creativity, and trust. As of right now, the Obama administration has tapped Andrew Slavitt, considered an Obamacare expert, to serve as acting administrator. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The fallout continues from the Swiss National Bank's decision to stop pegging its currency to the euro. 1.2 francs for every 1 euro had been the ratio that many players in the currency markets took as gospel. But when the Swiss Central Bank removed that backstop yesterday, man, oh man, did things get crazy. The franc soared as much as 40% against the euro, shocking traders who were betting that wouldn't happen. As Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, banks and brokerage firms were left holding the bag.
Boris Schlossberg spent much of today wondering if he'll be able to access the money in the accounts of his brokerage firm. He both researches foreign currencies at BK Asset Management and trades in them.
The amount of money that these brokers have lost is so much that they actually literally don't have enough capital to stay in business.
Because brokerage firms place trades on behalf of their customers like Schlossberg. And in the currency market, those trades might be really big, but the customer might only have to put down a very small fraction as a deposit.
What that means in layman's terms, basically, is that you need to just put down $2 to control 100.
That's leverage. Big returns if things work out, big losses if they don't. Some brokers are left covering those losses when their clients can't pay, so a handful are now raising the alarm about their own financial health. Banks can suffer losses, too. Nick Benenbrook is head of foreign exchange strategy at Wells Fargo.
Some of the other institutions within the financial markets are going to be still suffer losses, but be better placed to absorb the kind of difficulties that we're facing.
Benenbrook doesn't expect the franc's ripple effects to spread very far. But in situations like this, uncertainty in one market can spread to the next, says Kevin Jakes, a professor at Baldwin-Wallace University, and perhaps also to companies working across different currencies.
And so this kind of volatility in exchange rates can also be problematic for some of our multinational corporations, even if they're not financial companies.
If you're a Swiss company, your goods just got more expensive overnight, which was exactly what the Swiss National Bank was trying to prevent by pegging its currency to the euro in the first place. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the markets bounced back. Details when we do the numbers. It's time now for 4 minutes of live radio we call the Weekly Wrap. We look back at the biggest news of the week. And joining us from New York is Lee Gallagher with Fortune Magazine. And right across the table from me here in D.C. is Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Well, Lee, I want to start with you. This was a big week for banks announcing earnings, and profits were down at J.P. Morgan. They were down at Bank of America. What was dragging them down last quarter?
It was a number of things, but a lot of it for all of them, well, for almost all of them, was a decline in trading revenue. That's been an issue for the whole quarter and will likely be an issue. But you saw some other things, too. I mean, you know, with B of A, there was mortgage origination also slowed. And there's, you know, that's obviously going to be an ongoing problem with the housing market still where it is. And so it was a number of things, but I would say trading for Citi, legal costs were a big issue. But trading was probably the most consistent headline.
Sudeep, we just heard about the fallout from the Swiss bank's decision to change the way that it's pegged its rate. Put this into some perspective for us, just sort of what this means for the health of the European economy writ large.
It's certainly a huge move. You don't see a move in a currency market like this and not take notice. Currency traders are going to be telling their grandchildren about a week like this decades from now. But for the bigger picture, it's all about central bankers trying to defend their own turf and guard against what their colleagues and their competitors are doing around the world. And that's a big challenge. The European Central Bank next week is going to likely engage in its round of bond buying, quantitative easing, just like the Federal Reserve has done here, just like the Bank of Japan has done. And that's going to have some incredible ripple effects. We're already seeing them, and central bankers are trying to respond in what is a brave new world of currency devaluation and competitive easing.
Lee, I've heard so much about the contrast here between the U.S. economy and the European economy. What is all of this, what's happened with Switzerland, with Europe, say about the strength of our economy today?
Well, we're really the safe port in the storm. I mean, of all of the major regional economic zones, we are the strongest. And so, you know, that has a lot of raises a lot of questions. But, you know, we didn't think just a few years ago we'd be in this position, that's for sure. But everything, I mean, you know, everything in our economy right now is humming along pretty well. You know, if you look at jobs, if you look at consumer confidence, obviously helped by oil prices, which is a major boon to consumers, even as the rest of the world agonizes about what it means. It's helping. It's one of a number of things helping our economy right now.
The agony and the ecstasy. I wanted to ask you, Sudeep, about that. I mean, we have oil now hovering below $50 a barrel. Have we reached a low point? Could it go even lower? And what could the fallout from that continue to be?
It will certainly go lower. We have not come to the bottom yet, and we have to see some further fallout in the industry. This is a true global stare down. It's Saudi Arabia versus the rest of the world, particularly the shale producers in the United States. It knows as a leading producer, Saudi Arabia isn't going to take the hit for this one. And it knows that shale producers can't hold up and are going to have to start cutting back. We've only seen the beginning of that. Some layoffs in the oil industry in the U.S., some cutbacks to investment, but you actually have to see production drop. And that's going to take a number of months before production drops. And once that happens, then you'll actually see the bottom for oil, and oil traders will be looking to the future. But right now, they're looking for the bottom.
Lee, we're here on a Friday ahead of a long weekend. Following that, the president delivers his sixth State of the Union address, and he's really been on a publicity blitz over these last few days, sort of laying out proposals he plans to bring up again in that speech. One was about sick leave and family leave. Do you think that these have any shot of appealing to politicians on both sides of the aisle? This might be something that Congress will take up.
I think it's unlikely. You know, in a Republican-controlled Congress, it's not government what is seen as squeezing working families. But, you know, I think that this is a huge issue. It really is an important issue for our, you know, for working families, and also just for the achievement of women in the workplace. One thing I would actually like to see is paternity leave, which isn't talked about much, but which is actually on the decline these days. So all of these things help create, you know, a healthy, productive workplace for families and for women in particular.
Lee Gallagher with Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both very much, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, David.
Thanks.
The economy is now producing more than 250,000 jobs month in and month out. Unemployment, which was 10% during the recession, is now 5.6%, and there's no reason to think it won't continue to improve. Of course, there's long-term unemployment that's higher than it has been since World War II. Millions aren't looking for work, and real wages are stagnant for most Americans. Still, with unemployment this low and job creation this strong, it's hard to call the economy sick or even still recovering. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tackles some of the big questions we have about the economy today.
Trying to answer big questions such as, what's the job market like now in America? And what do we get out of our jobs anyway? I could have started, like so many times in the recession, at a local employment office or a job fair. Instead, for inspiration, I headed to a New Year's Eve rock show in Portland, Oregon, of a band I really like. Fun, right? Also, someone's actual job. Including this guy.
John Vancura, guitarist and sax player.
I asked him, aside from getting to say he's with the band, they're called March 4th Marching Band, what else does his job give him?
Getting paid to go to festivals, free booze.
So for a 20-something guitarist, work is for rent, food, and fun. And the 30-something bartender serving drinks in all this chaos? Hannah Harlow Bashore says when she's not managing the bar...
I'm also a hairstylist, makeup artist. I also do administrative work for doctors.
I like it.
It just makes me happy. All right, I have to start counting money.
So her work, many jobs actually, is for paying the bills, also working with others, being creative, keeping busy. Economist William Rogers at Rutgers University studies the changing American workforce. I asked him why people work.
Unfortunately, for many, the purpose of work is survival.
Rogers says the economy now is producing too many jobs that just pay the bare minimum. They don't offer a way up the economic ladder. He thinks work should offer more.
If we're creating workplaces where people aren't paid enough to meet their family's needs, aren't able to enjoy themselves, be creative, that's lower productivity. That's lower economic growth.
Social work professor Susan Lambert at the University of Chicago says the post-recession employment landscape is fundamentally altered, the result of financial crisis, labor-saving technology, perpetual corporate cost-cutting.
Employment has become more precarious.
Lambert identifies a key change, the rise of part-time, low-paid jobs, often temporary, with unpredictable schedules and never enough hours on the clock. She says this just-in-time type staffing is spreading in retail, but also in manufacturing, academia, journalism, and beyond.
People have a greater sense of insecurity. It makes it very difficult for people in jobs with unpredictable, unstable schedules to maintain employment because at some point often they have to decide their kids or their job.
Meanwhile, at the top, among college-educated professionals, the opposite is happening. People work a lot of hours, sure, but they also get more autonomy and flexibility, more income too. Lambert says we increasingly work in divided offices, with underpaid impermanent workers sitting right next to a lucky few who get to stay around and make a living. But economist Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum counters these employment trends are not some post-recession new normal.
The degree to which the world is somehow fundamentally different, this gets floated about every 5 years, and it's always overstated to a great extent. A very bad recession and financial crisis didn't change the fundamentals of how economies grow and the way people benefit from economic growth.
Holtz-Aiken predicts with just a little more economic growth, more people will land full-time, well-paying jobs that can become lifelong careers. But can those jobs of the future also offer workers the kind of creativity, conviviality, challenge, and sheer enjoyment that my New Year's revelers talked about? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it was weird. It cost $1,500 to buy a pair. It felt kind of elitist. It raised people's concerns about privacy.
Google Glass goes away for now. But first, let's do the numbers. Finally, an up day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average regained 190 points, 1.1% to close at 17,511. The NASDAQ climbed 63 points, 1.3%, finishing at 4634. And the S&P 500 added 26 points, 1.3% to end at 2019. For the week, the Dow lost 1.2%, the NASDAQ fell 1.4%, and the S&P was off 1.2%. Malls are losing not only customers, but retailers who built their businesses to cater to them. Shares of Wet Seal, which sells fashion to teenage girls, were already near zero, but plunged 48% more when Wet Seal filed for bankruptcy. Shares are now pennies apiece. European markets were up. Britain's FTSE gained 0.75%. France's CAC 40 and Germany's DAX added 1.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Markets are closed for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Hey, tennis fans, get ready to make some racket. The first Grand Slam of the season gets underway, the Australian Open. And she's famous for her role in the horror film The Birds, one of many credits. Actress Tippi Hedren turns 85. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. We've passed a sobering milestone in this country. For the first time in at least 50 years, the majority of students in public schools are considered poor. According to the Southern Education Foundation, more than half of students in 2013 qualified for free or reduced price lunch. That's a widely used, if imperfect, measure of poverty. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott looks at what today's report means for schools and the economy.
Steve Suits crunched the numbers for the Southern Education Foundation. He says we tend to think of poverty as a problem concentrated in rural areas or the inner city. In fact, those boundaries are falling away.
Even in the suburbs, low-income students are now 40% of the student population in the public schools.
Suits says there are lots of reasons for the shift.
Birth rates, immigration, and the economy, which simply is not giving people enough income to get away from poverty.
The new report is based on how many students qualify for free and reduced price meals at school. For a family of four in 2013, that meant earning less than $43,000 a year. Matthew Chingos with the Brookings Institution says a change in the numbers may reflect growing poverty.
But it also could have to do with which families choose to sign up for this federal free lunch program. So if we're trying to measure the level of poverty in the United States, there are much better measures that do that directly.
But measures like census data also show growing child poverty, especially in the South and parts of the West. David Sciarra directs the Education Law Center. He says funding to teach those children hasn't kept pace.
So you couple concentrated poverty with a lack of resources, and that spells trouble for students, it spells trouble for schools, and really for the economies of these states.
Sciarra says it costs more to teach poor children. They need more highly qualified teachers, tutoring, and after-school and summer programs to try to make up for the advantages they don't have at home. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Have you ever heard of John Law? Well, John Law was a Scottish financier credited with introducing paper money to the masses in the 18th century. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer introduces us now to the father of modern money.
John Law made his way to France in the early 1700s, apparently fleeing London to escape a death sentence for murder. Things were better in France.
He was just a very popular person.
John Moen is chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Mississippi. He says in 1716, Law charmed the French government into letting him open a bank. It issued paper money to the public. Until then, most people paid for stuff with gold. Then Law started a trading company to extract resources from France's colony in Louisiana. Moen says Law sold shares in the new company.
So he was kind of able to finance his trading companies around the world under the assumption that eventually my trading companies are going to really pay off.
Only they didn't. His investors panicked. Law's critics say he built up a bubble and it burst. Doug Noland is a senior portfolio manager at Federated Investors.
And then, you know, the more the stock price went up, the more people wanted to buy more shares. So it was an experiment in paper money, but it was also a classic example of a mania.
Now, Law's so-called bubble is often touted as a cautionary tale. Critics of the Federal Reserve say the money it's pumped into the economy is creating a bubble that will burst as wide open as Law's trading company did. George Selgin is with the libertarian Cato Institute.
Then it looks a lot more like John Law's bank pumping out notes, where John Law is really a name for Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen.
John Law isn't here to defend himself, but at least he's getting some name recognition in Washington. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Google just made an announcement that next week the company will stop selling Google Glass, that piece of wearable technology that looks kind of like a broken pair of eyeglasses from the future. There's a screen, you can listen to music and make phone calls, you can shoot video, take pictures, there's even GPS navigation that's built in. Well, the device never caught on. A headset sells for $1,500, and consensus seems to be it looks weird and it's made a lot of people uncomfortable. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he joins us now from New York. Hey, Ben.
Hi, David.
Can we construe this as a failure for Google? Here's a product that they introduced and today discontinued.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some respects, yes, right? This is the perfect example of how Google's design and product philosophy can fail. The company had this kind of incredible idea of augmented reality where you could put data in front of you while you're just sort of going through life. And we've been imagining this since, what, the first Terminator movie, David? but it wasn't really a fully developed product. Google came with the technology, tethered it to your phone, and expected people to, like, make stuff for it, right? And it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes you have to come with like a full concept for people to get involved. And it was a controversial idea. It was weird. It cost $1,500 to buy a pair. It felt kind of elitist. It raised people's concerns about privacy, right? And maybe driving with these things on. There were a lot of problems. And Google just didn't make, I think, a strong argument enough with the hardware to make this happen.
So is Google Glass going away? Is this technology going to sort of live on in some other way?
I think it is. It's not going away. Tony Fadell, who you may remember as the guy who heads up Nest, which is the smart home part of Google's...
The smart thermostat thing?
Exactly. So Tony Fadell is now going to manage the Google Glass part of Google. And we might see some interesting things play out there. The company says it's no longer selling the pairs of glasses, but under Fadell, there could be some interesting things that play out there.
What do you make of the way in which Google did this, introducing a beta product, making it available to consumers, and then deciding, you know what, this isn't working out the way that we thought it was going to work out, this isn't catching on to the extent we thought it would, we're not going to do it anymore. That's kind of uncommon, isn't it?
Well, it is a little bit, and it's hard to tell what their thinking was there in some respects. I mean, it could have been that they knew that there were going to be concerns about privacy, that this thing could become dangerous if it was used in the wrong way, and they wanted to sort of roll it out carefully. But I think it was a misstep for the company. I think they should have developed it in-house as Apple would have done. I mean, think about Steve Jobs when he released the iPhone, right? That piece of hardware was so just perfectly finished. It was ready for prime time, and everybody who touched it became an evangelist, right? Everybody who touched glass did not become an evangelist, and I think that was part of the problem for the company.
What happens to these early testers of Google Glass who spent $1,500 on a pair of these things? Are these things going to keep working? Is Google going to keep supporting them? What happens to them?
Yeah, I think the apps will continue to be supported, David. That's my impression, at least. They're not trying to cut it off. But it's, I think we're going to see less and less people wearing them, even less than we do already. I think we're going to see this, at least in the iteration that we are familiar with, we're going to see it sort of go away.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
We have a list of other new product fails. You can check that out on Facebook, where you can also add your own.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, it is a time-honored tradition here in Washington for the president's rivals to offer rebuttals to the State of the Union before the president even delivers the State of the Union. And that's even easier this year because the president has spent the last few days previewing his speech. He's introduced new tuition breaks for community college students. Well, House Speaker John Boehner attacked that particular plan in a novel way this morning in an email with this subject line, 12 Taylor Swift GIFs for you, where he used a different GIF of Taylor Swift to illustrate his argument that the president's plan will cost taxpayers too much money. You can find a link to that on our website. And also, apparently, John Boehner is a Taylor Swift fan. And that's it. That's Marketplace today. Today, the Dow gained 190 points, 1 1/10%. The NASDAQ climbed 63 points, 1 1/3%. And the S&P 500 added 26 points, 1 1/3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Markets are closed Monday, but we'll be here. I'll talk to you then. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.